The text on this page is Gregory Nazianzen's Oration 38 on the Theophany, which is a wonderful reminder of how his theology also incorporated the tradition of theosis, of divinization, as a way of understanding the nature of the Incarnation and the work which God has done for us. He is appropriating especially the theosis theology of Saint Athanasius. It's important in understanding Gregory Nazianzen to be aware of his background and his connection to the other great Cappadocian fathers. Gregory Nazianzen was made a bishop at the insistence of his good friend, St. Basil the Great. Basil and Gregory Nazianzen had met in Athens when they were both in school there and remained friends after they finished in Athens. They both participated in what you might call monastic experiments. They lived apart in seclusion and undertook a form of monastic life, more like the otium of classical antiquity, really, and had the opportunity to support one another in their sense of a commitment to a monastic way of life. But then Basil found himself caught up in and called into ecclesiastical politics and was made the bishop of the important see of Caesarea. He became the staunch defender of the Nicene position and found himself politically in the situation of needing to have around him bishops whom he could trust who were supportive of the Nicene position. This was difficult because, of course, the imperial politics under the successors of Constantine up until the time of the rise of the Emperor Theodosius was heavily Arian, and Basil faced a great deal of opposition from many imperial officials. So he was very concerned to appoint his friends to as many dioceses as he could as they became available. And so he, in effect, forced Gregory Nazianzen to accept the diocese of Sasima, sight unseen, and Gregory then discovered that this diocese was in fact an extremely unimportant little backwater town, hardly a town at all, barely a place where horses would be changed on the way from one town to another, and Gregory, virtually in disgust, left the place without even properly taking possession of the see and went back to help his own father, who was the bishop of Nazianzus. Gregory is known by the name of a see which was not his own. He was not the bishop of Nazianzus. That was his father's see, but he continued to assist his father once Gregory had himself been made a bishop, but technically he was the bishop of Sasima. This was the beginnings of a kind of a rift between Basil and Gregory's, whose friendship has been greatly celebrated and is constantly referred to throughout the tradition. Gregory, on some levels, never really forgave his friend for having made him the bishop of such an unimportant place. But nonetheless, he loved Basil very greatly, and the two of them were influential on one another. Gregory became the ongoing spokesman for Basil's important position and work at Basil's death. Basil, as we will recall, was the leader of the Nicene Party, who continued the work of Athanasius in reconciling the homoiousians to the Nicene position and effectively promoted and made available the language of ousia, of the essence of God, being the way of describing the a commonality between Father, Son, and then eventually also of Holy Spirit, whereas the term hypostasis would refer to the distinction between the persons, hypostasis as person. That's Basil's great contribution, which Gregory Nazianzen takes up and continues to pass along to the tradition, as we will see. On the death of Basil, and Basil, by the way, was also a very important contributor to the monastic tradition in that as bishop he made quite a number of monastic foundations, principally monasteries that would be involved in assisting in the pastoral and apostolic work of the diocese. By pastoral, I don't mean necessarily serving as priests or as preachers, but assisting monetarily and helping to found institutions, particularly institutions that could be of assistance to the sick and to the poor. Basil died in 379, just as the Nicene cause was beginning to rise up and would eventually triumph in 381 with the Council of Constantinople that would be called by the Emperor Theodosius. But Gregory Nazianzen, his friend, whom he had made a bishop, then became the spokesman at Basil's death for the Nicene position, and he was called to become the spokesperson and the champion of the Nicene cause in the Diocese of Constantinople, which was still a bit dangerous because imperial policy still favored Arianism. This was before Theodosius' rise to power. And Gregory accepted the Church of the Anastasis, the Church of the Resurrection in Constantinople, and in that church preached his famous theological orations, which represent still his greatest contribution to the theological tradition, his articulation of the theology of the Trinity, which was intended to be an explication of the Nicene position for both bishops and lay people as well. He did such a wonderful job that he came to the attention of the then rising Emperor Theodosius, who made Gregory Nazianzen the Archbishop of Constantinople. This, unfortunately, was not something that Gregory was able to cope with particularly well. There is another parallel. Basil had, by the way, also made his own brother, Gregory of Nyssa, Bishop of Nyssa, and Gregory of Nyssa, although a brilliant theologian and tremendous contributor to the mystical theological tradition, was not a very good church administrator, and he was accused of incompetence and withdrew from his diocese for a number of years, then found his way back towards the end of his life. In the same way, in a kind of a parallel way, Gregory Nazianzen, although a brilliant theologian, didn't really understand church politics very well. Having been made by Theodosius the Archbishop of the most important diocese now in the East, or what was becoming the most important diocese, he naturally faced the enmity of the other great bishops of the other important dioceses, and the right for him to be archbishop was challenged. And he didn't quite know how to respond. He'd already had a great disappointment in the form of a trusted friend and what he thought was a theological colleague in the person of a man named Maximus, known as Maximus the Cynic, who turned out to be a conniver, a schemer, who, with the assistance of other bishops gathered at the time of the Council of Constantinople, secretly arranged to be a consecrated bishop in Constantinople. And in fact, one of the canons of the council particularly emphasizes that this consecration was illicit and indeed invalid. Well, Gregory was terribly disappointed by this and really quite shocked that someone he had trusted would turn against him. He was even more shocked at the accusation of the invalidity of his appointment to Constantinople because he was Bishop of Sosima. And the Council of Nicaea had declared that bishops could not be transferred from diocese to diocese. Gregory did not know how to respond. It was presumed by people that he would fight, but instead he turned to the Emperor Theodosius and offered his resignation. Basically said, well, if you wish my resignation in this case, you may have it. And Theodosius, who evidently wanted a stronger man in this position, accepted Gregory's resignation. So during the council, Gregory resigned as Archbishop of Constantinople, not really expecting his resignation to be accepted. It was accepted. He withdrew from the city very sadly, and for the rest of his life continued to write orations, very learned and rather beautiful treatises and poetry, but which are filled with a spirit of lament and a sense of having been ill-used. Well, what we have in this text of Gregory's oration number 38 on the Theophany is a reminder of his use of the theology of theosis, of divinization, that tradition which he inherited from Athanasius and which was so important in the 4th century as a way of understanding the Incarnation. And we will particularly see this if you drop down to the highlighted text in chapter 7. He begins, God always was and always is and always will be, or rather, God always is. He is using the notion of God's eternal being, God's transcendence on the one hand, and yet, miraculously, he's preaching on the feast of the Incarnation. This transcendence becomes imminent, becomes incarnate. God, if you drop down a bit towards the paragraph with the highlighted text, is incomprehensible on the one hand, but nevertheless being desired to purify, and by purifying, to make us like God. God's intention is that we might become like God Himself, so that when we have thus become like Himself, God may, to use a bold expression, hold converse with us as gods. So God's intention is that we should be able to enter into a kind of communion, a prosomalia. This is a term that Evagrius of Pontus and then later others used to describe prayer. Prayer, this conversation with God, is possible because God has enabled us to enter into conversation with us, because He has divinized us, gifted us with the divine nature, so that conversation, prayer that is, might be possible for us. And if we then drop down to chapter 9, this movement, he says, of self-contemplation alone could not satisfy God's goodness, God's inter-Trinitarian, his within himself contemplation is not sufficient, but God must pour himself out. This notion of kenosis, this outpouring that we find in the New Testament, is going forth to multiply the objects of God's own goodness, his beneficence. Then if we drop down again to the next highlighted text, which will be in chapter 13, you will see down in the highlighted text, he who gives riches becomes poor. This outpouring of God involves, as Gregory describes it here, the assumption of poverty of my flesh, that I may assume the richness of his Godhead. God pours himself out that we might receive the gift of divinity. In the next paragraph, I had a share in the image, but I did not keep it, and thus he partakes of my flesh that he may both save the image and make the flesh immortal. The incarnation is for the purpose of bestowing immortality in salvation, and this is more godlike than the former action. That is, Christ is imparting his better nature. He is imparting a communion with himself. So we see in this text that Gregory's homily on the incarnation presupposes this great tradition of theosis, of divinization. Christ is humbling himself for the purpose of raising us up. And this gives us a little insight, a little hint of some of the great contributions that Gregory Nazianzen makes as the great spokesperson for the Nicene position after the death of Basil. And his gift of the great theological orations is one that continues to be treasured by the churches today.